the president and the White House, it's within their authority and power to immediately issue an executive order abolishing critical race theory trainings from the federal government. And I call on the president to immediately issue this executive order and stamp out this destructive, divisive, pseudoscientific ideology at its root. And I think that it's something that he's denounced, this kind of Black Lives Matter and neo-Marxist rhetoric in places like Portland and Seattle. But it's time to take action and destroy it within his own administration.
Christopher Rufo, speaking on Fox News' Tucker Carlson back in September of last year, calling on then-President Trump to issue an executive order banning critical race theory training in the U.S. government. And a few weeks later, Trump did just that. He ordered an end to racial sensitivity training for federal employees, though President Biden reversed that order. Christopher Rufo is hardly a household name, but he became a key player in the national debate over critical race theory. It's a decades-old legal framework, and its central idea is that racism is systemic, it's beyond individual prejudices, and it's embedded in our institutions. So why are we talking about it now? My next guest says it's because Rufo made it so. Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he profiled Rufo for the magazine. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you interviewed him for your article, and he told you this entire movement came from nothing, which is kind of shocking.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, right now, if you look at conservative media, if you listen to conservative politicians, this is their cry that critical race theory is an ideology that has taken over, you know, educational institutions, corporate training. It's the cry is that this is a sort of insidious, you know, set of ideas that is creeping its way into all kinds of corners of American life and needs to be countered. You know, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, nobody was talking about critical race theory. Nobody would have described it as, you know, a kind of active part of, you know, American public or political life. You know, one of the what Rufo sort of managed to do was to take a set of kind of organic objections to anti-racism seminars, you know, to implicit bias trainings that people, some people had, and develop a kind of theory and say, look, you know, what you're seeing at your place of work or your school isn't just, you know, the work of an HR department or a particularly progressive social studies teacher. In fact, there's this whole insidious ideology that goes back to, you know, revolutionary work in the 1960s that's at work here. And so it's urgent mm-hmm. that conservatives sort of step up and stop it.
So is this the second iteration of the attack on the 1619 Project and this idea of slavery being a key part of the founding of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even make it that specific. You know, I think what's happened over the last couple of years is that the kind of public and semi-public conversation about race has grown much more progressive, and corporations and, you know, schools, universities that might not have saw fit to conduct, you know, to make public statements about where they stood on race and to conduct, you know, anti-racism sort of trainings and seminars have been doing so. And, you know, from my own perspective, that's a good thing. You know, that's a helpful thing. But it's also not surprising that it would kick up, you know, some backlash and some reaction. And so I think, you know, even less specifically than, you know, in the debates over the teaching of history and the 1619 Project, there's just a general sense among, you know, conservatives and people who are unsure about progressive teaching on race, that things have changed, that there's, you know, a lot more talk about structural racism, about implicit bias, about, you know, just the way that race plays in everyday life in a way that might feel intrusive to some people. And so I think what we're seeing is sort of, you know, just a kind of generalized reaction to that mm-hmm. kind of made specific and given a name and a title, somewhat
right.
opportunistic.
So let's talk more about Rufo and his role in this. He appears on Tucker Carlson in September. We just heard a clip from that appearance. It's a big moment for him because he's nobody really knows who he is. And then President Trump happens to be watching, and he sees him on Tucker Carlson that night. And then you write in your article, the very next day, he gets a call from Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and he's flown out to Washington to help draft that executive order.
Yeah, wow. I mean, at some level, like not super surprising that Trump was watching Tucker Carlson tonight, if we know much about the president, you know, as a pretty daily viewer. And Rufo himself suspected that Trump might be watching. But yeah, I mean, you know, at some level, this is sort of a story about the kind of explosive power of conservative media within the conservative movement. You know, Rufo goes on this program, is helping to draft the White House's executive order within a matter of days, you know, continues to, that gives him sort of more momentum. He continues to publish what he calls exposés about, you know, anti-racism seminars that, you know, have some elements that might seem extreme. And, you know, Glenn Beck devotes an hour of his program to this topic. Tucker Carlson lets Rufo deliver the opening monologue on his show. Rufo gets involved with, you know, the state legislatures that are drafting bills. There's just like an incredible sort of lucky kind of opportunism to this. And what he did, I think, that let him take this sort of place in the movement and kind of shape it, was he gave it a different kind of name. You know, conservatives had been objecting to progressive talk on race by calling it woke or denouncing it as cancel culture, or in a previous generation describing it as, you know, political correctness run amok. And, you know, what Rufo said to me is that critical race theory, the label, was the perfect villain because it suggested a kind of, you know, deep, academic, intent that was sort of outside of the lives of ordinary people. It also placed race at its center in a way that conservatives thought they might be able to weaponize. And so, you know, what he did was take what I think are kind of relatively mundane or pre-existing set of conservative complaints, and just give them a new package. And all of a sudden we've got, you know, a dozen bills in state legislatures around the country. And, you know, I'm getting emails from all kinds of conservative senators fundraising off this. And, you know, yeah, the president's passing an executive order banning this school of thought, you know, whatever that means, from being taught in diversity seminars by federal contractors. So, you know, it was a real kind of explosive character to how this idea kind of took off.
Well, Benjamin, thanks for coming on and explaining that.
Sure.
Benjamin Wallace Wells, he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. So let's talk more about what critical race theory really is. It emerged decades ago as a legal theory, and here to tell us more is Kendall Thomas. He's a professor at Columbia Law School. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, thanks for joining us. So we just heard that it's actually this term, critical race theory, is being used by conservatives for a whole stew of things that they don't like, basically political correctness run amok. But it is actually an actual theory that was founded, what, in the late 70s, early 80s. Can you, in legal circles, can you talk about that?
Well, critical race theory is a loose set of ideas and approaches that tries to understand the unfair and inequitable ways that racial power has been woven into the fabric of American institutions, education, healthcare, workplace, the legal system, even in the sports world. What critical race theory is not about is assigning individual blame or guilt or hatred. It's about the systemic and structural harms of colorblind racism, the laws and policies that don't explicitly mention race, but which somehow reproduce and normalize racial inequality. And so critical race theory was an effort largely by people trained as lawyers working on law to understand how in the absence of explicit laws that harm people explicitly on the basis of race, the law could reproduce these sorts of injustices and disadvantages that were most certainly about race and which had a clear, disparate racial impact. Rufo's and the other people who are attacking critical race theory as part of this purge politics that Donald Trump picked up, they know they can't be anti-racist, but they can be anti-CRT because, as Benjamin said, they can make CRT into this monster that means whatever they want it to mean. But they could, in fact, care less about critical race theory. The folks behind the attacks on critical race theory know that if they can weaponize racism and stoke racial fear and distrust, they can distract us, rather, from the failures of our public school system and many other parts of our government to serve all Americans. I actually come from the same part of the country that Christopher Rufo comes from. He was raised in Sacramento. I grew up in a little town to the north called Oroville, California. And I watched as a child how white right-wing racial identity politics, something I didn't have a name for, could scar and harm the lives of entire communities of people of color in the town in which I grew up. And Rufo may not know this, but he grew up in Sacramento in a place in which institutional racism was alive and well. And in fact, Rufo knows that institutional racism is real. Privately, these folks are willing to concede that, as Justice Scalia did in 1987. In a private memo to the other members of the Supreme Court, in which he flat out admitted institutional racism in our criminal justice system, in our juries, among our prosecutors, is real and ineradicable. What Rufo and others want to maintain is a kind of racial indifference, a politics of racial indifference that will maintain a status quo in which structural racism seems natural, eternal, and to use Scalia's words, ineradicable. What critical race theory teaches is that it's not natural and it's not ineradicable if we have the strength and the will to reckon with the legacy of racism and the scar on the American body politic that our refusal to deal with our racial past is and will continue to inflict upon us.
And it's interesting that a lot of this is coming down to schools and what can and cannot be taught in schools, as many of these culture wars do trickle down into, is the education. I think at least five states have passed laws limiting how racism and sexism can be talked about in schools, and many more are considering similar bills.
That's right. And if they're not passing laws, they're passing resolutions like the Georgia State School Board did, even as Georgia is about to enter a fiscal year in which $1 billion, almost $1 billion, is going to be cut from the public education budget as we try to emerge from this pandemic. Fundamentally, as Chief Justice Earl Warren said in 1954 in the great case of Brown versus the Board of Education, public education is absolutely vital to a democratic society. As the Supreme Court said in that case, public schools are the place where our children learn to become citizens and where we equip them with the skills they will need to participate effectively in our democratic republic. We cannot prepare our children for a future in a multiracial, multicultural democracy by imposing a gag rule on our teachers who want to teach them the full history of the United States. That history is painful. It hurts. But that history is also going to be the way we can find ourselves as an American people to healing of the lingering wounds of racism.
Kendall Thomas, professor at Columbia Law School, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, why the Mormon Church secretly worked to create a bill legalizing medical marijuana. That story is next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Legal cannabis is becoming the norm in the United States. Most states have passed some type of legal medical or recreational marijuana law. It is a sign of a major shift in public opinion over the past decade, and that shift is probably most evident in Utah, one of the most religious and conservative states in the United States, of course, home to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known as the Mormon Church. And yet it is a place where voters legalized medical marijuana back in 2018. A bill was crafted with input from the LDS Church and advocates. And this could really serve as an example for other conservative states to welcome medical marijuana. Natalie Fertig recently wrote about this for Politico, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. All right, well, let's go back in time to 2015 in Utah. And a Republican state senator named Mark Madsen introduced a medical marijuana bill. First of all, why did he introduce it? And then what happened?
Yeah, so Senator Madsen personally found that medical marijuana was helpful for himself with some chronic pain that he had. And so when he found out more about medical marijuana and how it could be helpful and how it could replace opiates, he started to advocate for it himself in the state capitol. And there were some other lawmakers who partnered with him on it and a number of advocates. And a large number of these lawmakers and these advocates were also members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But the church opposed the bill pretty quickly. And Senator Madsen actually said that they came to him in his office and said, hey, we're going to go and ask leadership to kill this bill.
Well, just talk a little bit more about Senator Mark Madsen and how, well, I guess revolutionary it was that he, of all people, introduced this bill, because he is kind of Mormon royalty in Utah, right?
Yeah, he is. He's the grandson of a former, you know, top leader of the Mormon Church. And so his family is well known in Utah. You know, he said that in some ways that helped because he has this family that's well known and that's obviously very respected within the LDS community. But, you know, he also did get a lot of pushback for suggesting this legislation. So when he first introduced this, people were, you know, saying, why do you want to give people drugs? You know, that's not what the Mormon religion does and not what the Mormon religion supports. I mean, they, for the most part, don't even drink coffee. So it was very sort of shocking and unexpected that he would do this.
Right. And 90% of the state legislature is Mormon, right? And so, and then the teachings, are they pretty explicit that they're anti-marijuana?
The word marijuana was not specifically in the handbook. So the LDS Church has the Mormon handbook, and it's companion to, you know, the Book of Mormon. And it just has a lot of different guidelines for how to live your life. And in the handbook, it says that you should abstain from tobacco, alcohol, and coffee, as well as substances that are harmful, illegal, or addictive, or that impair judgment. And so marijuana is kind of clumped into that harmful, illegal, addictive, impaired judgment.
So no surprise the church would say, okay, we're against this. This is not going to fly.
Yeah, no surprise. The complicated thing is that it's also church theology to be helping sick people and to be compassionate and to just help people who are in need. And so for lawmakers like Madsen, who are part of the church, and for some of the advocates that I talked to, they were really clinging and pointing to those verses in the Book of Mormon about caring for other people. Hmm. So it's these kind of conflicting parts of theology or religious practice that were coming head to head.
So it's killed. It doesn't go anywhere in the legislature. And then what happens?
So then the advocates, so they actually try a couple times and it gets killed a couple times. And early 2018, late 2017, they say, let's take this to the voters and let's put a ballot measure up. Utah is one of the states that has a ballot measure process. They got enough signatures and more to get it on the ballot. It was polling around 72% popularity. And this is where that difference comes in, that theological difference, where a lot of the people who were just active members of the Mormon Church in Utah looked at this and they said, you know, we have medicines for other things. How is this different? So the church came out swinging hard against the ballot measure. They sent an email to all church members in Utah saying, don't vote for this ballot measure, which is not a measure that they take often. They're usually working more behind the scenes. But the popularity of the measure was still staying really high. And so the church, as they're still sending these emails and saying, hey, don't vote for the ballot measure, behind the scenes, they start reaching out to the advocates and they say, hey, we want to come up with a compromise. We're going to make sure that this happens in a way that we're comfortable with.
But they didn't make that public. Publicly, they were saying, don't vote for this. Behind the scenes, they were realizing this is unstoppable and they need to figure out how to help control it.
Yes. So there was multiple months where they were working behind the scenes to create this compromise on the ballot measure where they were still publicly opposing the ballot measure.
Okay, so the voters have their say and it's approved. What does the church do to make sure that they get a bill that they like?
So just before the election in October, the church and the advocates and law enforcement and lawmakers and all of these different stakeholders got together in this very fancy room and they said, we have come to a decision and we have made an agreement on medical marijuana and we are going to pass a medical marijuana bill. And they sort of withdrew their opposition to the ballot measure and said, people, you can vote however you see fit. We're going to replace it either way with this bill that we came up with. So that's much more conservative than the ballot measure was. It has more limitations on things. You can't smoke flower, for example. You can only vape flower. Packaging is very, I've been to a lot of California dispensaries and they are bright and colorful and there are lots of different products and cool, sleek packages. In Utah, they're just black and white. They're trying to approach it more as medicine than as this like fun recreational thing.
Are other states, other conservative states looking to Utah as a way to embrace just medical marijuana and maybe avoid the whole controversy over recreational marijuana?
Yeah. So one of the lawmakers I talked to in Utah said that he has been reached out to by lawmakers in Kansas who are interested in how Utah did their program. Also Idaho, which also has a very large LDS population in the state of Idaho. And then there's some national advocates who say that, you know, they kind of point to Utah sometimes, in addition to a couple other states, as examples for some of the southern conservative, much more religious states that are still very wary of recreational marijuana. But the religious aspect says we have to take care of people. And some advocates are saying, hey, we can take Utah's model and show it to some of these states that are maybe worried about that tension and give them a model that will not feel so lackadaisical about how marijuana becomes available in the state.
Natalie Fertig, she covers cannabis for Politico, where you can read her story on how medical marijuana was legalized in Utah. Natalie, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up, Is there a multiverse? Just one of the conversations scientists are having that are also being discussed on the animated series Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty just kind of tapped right into that. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of universes, and Rick just passes in between them with abandon.
The real science of Rick and Morty next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you recognize this theme music, then you are probably a fan of Rick and Morty. The animated show follows the misadventures of a mad scientist named Rick and his awkward, anxious 14-year-old grandson, Morty. Each week, Rick drags his grandson into adventures that often include space travel, battles with alien life forms, cloning, portal guns that open up wormholes to other dimensions. Rick even turned himself into a pickle to avoid going to family therapy.
Morty!
Rick? Where are you?
On my workbench, Morty.
Are you invisible and you're gonna, like, fart on me?
Flip the pickle, Morty. You're not gonna regret it. The payoff is huge. I turned myself into a pickle, Morty! Boom! Big reveal, I'm a pickle!
Season 5 of the Adult Swim favorite just kicked off, and at least one science teacher wrote a whole book about the science in Rick and Morty. Joining us is Matt Brady. He teaches high school biology and chemistry in North Carolina. He's the author of The Science of Rick and Morty, the unofficial guide to Earth's stupidest show. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, you don't really think it's stupid, do you?
I don't. And actually, just a secret between you and me, the original publisher of the book put that title on it, and I kind of just had to go along with it. But
gotcha.
I don't think it's stupid at all.
Right, because the show is really, really smart. It's really sometimes hard to follow all the permutations. For people who aren't familiar with it, can you just explain the basic premise and what happens in a typical episode?
I think you said it best. It's a kind of a mad scientist grandfather who is irreverent and can create anything and can and will travel anywhere and invent anything. And he takes his grandson Morty along with him.
You teach high school science. Do you use it to teach science with your students?
I use a lot of pop culture in my classes. I use Marvel movies. I use comic books. I use television shows. I try to keep abreast of what my kids are into. I don't use too much Rick and Morty. As my wife reminds me, I like to have a roof over my head and my food warm. Rick and Morty is a little bit too risque, I think, for most high school classrooms. The kids know what it is and what it's about, and I kind of have a slight underground following, I guess, of students that watch it in my school and know that I wrote the book, but I don't use it as an example. I'll use the information that's in the book and kind of draw some parallels and hint at it, but I won't use clips from the show or anything like that. It's still a little bit risky.
But your book does. So your book delves into the episodes where science, well, it could be real. And first of all, do we know if they have any kind of a serious science advisor on the show? Because, he delves into a lot of complicated theories and ideas on the show.
He does. To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe they do. I think they have a very well-educated, with the creators, Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland, and their writer's room. I think they keep abreast and they know what's at the cutting or the bleeding edge of science and just some interesting ideas to go with. I think now that they've gotten the pattern of the type of science that Rick is involved with, they can kind of keep an eye out for things that might work in Rick's world.
Well, let's talk about the pickle episode, since we already heard Rick being the pickle. And you talk about it in your book. At one point, Rick attaches himself to a cockroach's body, I guess.
He takes over a cockroach by stimulating its brain with his tongue. I feel so weird saying this out loud. When he's a pickle, he cracks off the top of the cockroach's exoskeleton, the carapace there, and is able to stimulate the what passes for a brain in a cockroach and make it move the way he needs it to. That's based on real science. That's, you can make a cockroach do things by stimulating the nerves, the clump of nerves that pass for a brain in a cockroach. There's a company that will sell you a little backpack kit that you can put on a cockroach, and there's an app on your phone, and you can end up with a little cockroach surgery driving your cockroach, making it go to the left or to the right because you put little electrodes in its antenna, and it, when you stimulate that, it feels like something is there, so it goes the other way.
Huh. And why would you do that to a cockroach? I mean, of all the bugs in the world, why is a cockroach a good subject for that?
The company, this Backyard Brains that does this, they're not sending this out to suggest that people should torture cockroaches that way. There is interest in doing this, and I go into this in the book, kind of tying it to real world science and applications, that, okay, if we can perhaps wire cockroaches to do what we want them to do, cockroaches can get in anywhere. In the case of a collapsed building or scene of a natural disaster, a cockroach with a very small camera on it could squeeze into places and tell us, you know, show us what's in that confined space.
Hmm. Well, speaking of how neurons work and the brain, there's another episode called Morty's Mind Blowers, in which we discover that Rick has removed all his bad memories and placed them in a room. Obviously, that can't be done.
Sure.
But yeah, you do talk about how memory can be manipulated.
Yes, it can be. And that it's relatively easy to do. When you remember something, your brain is laying down the pathways just by following that neuronal trail that makes up the memory, physically makes up the memory in your brain. And if I ask you to remember something, that memory, while you're remembering it, is vulnerable. I can insert something new in there. So in the book, I talk about a study that was done with people who they were reminded about this event that supposedly happened when they were teenagers, that this big fight kind of happened at school and the police were called. It never happened, but they were reminded about it and asked about it. And their parents even kind of got into it with it. And after not too long at all, the people started, quote unquote, remembering this thing that didn't happen, which is kind of frightening. And a couple of those studies where they do look at that, they ended early because it worked too well.
Oh, wow. And I guess that's why police don't really like to use eyewitness accounts when there's a crime, because memory is notoriously faulty.
Exactly.
A lot of the far out ideas in Rick and Morty involve multiverses and simulated worlds. And you talk about that in your book, whether or not there is such a thing as a multiverse, because we are in a universe as we know it. First of all, what is a multiverse?
At its simplest, it's the idea that our universe is not the only one. And it can either mean that there's a universe where the Nazis won World War II, or a universe where dogs became the predominant species of intelligence on Earth. We're seeing that more and more in our pop culture. Avengers Endgame played with that, and the upcoming Marvel movies are going to play with that. DC Comics has always had a multiverse. And so Rick and Morty just kind of tapped right into that. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of universes. And Rick just passes in between them with abandon, taking Morty with him and finding different versions of himself all along. That actually, I teach physics, and I kind of am excited about this idea that maybe in 20 or 30 years, when we start teaching about kind of cosmology, it will be, yeah, we're in a multiverse. Evidence is really suggesting we're probably in a multiverse, not a universe. And that's a neat idea that kind of took root in science fiction, and then the cosmology came along and supports that idea as well.
Would it really mean that there are multiple versions of, let's say, this interview right now happening?
And I'm in a fish tank and you're in a fish tank. And
yeah.
Possibly. That's one version. There's the many worlds hypothesis. That's the kind of one that's one of the more popular ones in pop culture, of instead of turning left, you turned right. And there's that whole other universe where you turned left, that all these other different things happen to you. For every decision that you made, the other decision was made, and that split off into a multiple universe or a copy of the universe. And it's an infinite number of universes. There are other simpler versions of that, of the multiverse, when we think about our observable universe, our little bubble that we can't see past the edge of because of how light travels. What's past the edge of what we can see in our universe? Well, there's no reason to think that there's not more universe or more space with stars and stuff in it out there. That functionally, what's outside of our observable universe is another universe to us, because we can't get there. They don't know that we exist. We don't know that they exist, but it's out there. It's kind of like a patchwork quilt type of thing that just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
And that brings us to alien life form, because that is a constant theme in Rick and Morty. And you attack that one early on in the book. And we are talking in the country right now, possible UFOs, alien life form. Mm-hmm. But I guess, where is science on that right now? Is there a consensus that there could be some life out there? Intelligent life,
I think there's a lot of hopeful feelings. There's no evidence. It's part of what Perseverance is looking for on Mars. Mm-hmm. I know there's always kind of at NASA and JPL, there's a mission on some burner somewhere to send a probe to Enceladus, which is a moon orbiting Saturn, or Europa, which is around Jupiter, and drill through the ice on the surface to see what's in the water underneath, the relatively warm salt water that's underneath. Life is, when you break it down to the physics and the energy and the chemistry, life is almost inevitable. It's going to happen given enough time and the right ingredients and the right amount of energy. Now, whether that life evolves up to something that walks on two legs or six and drives a spaceship to go visit its neighbors, that's a whole other question. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to think within my lifetime, or maybe within my students' lifetime, we'll get some kind of positive result from somewhere in our solar system, that there's other bacteria, there are viruses, maybe there's little brine shrimp in the salty moon of Enceladus, in the salty ocean of Enceladus there. But finding aliens that can drive a spaceship to come to Earth, I know we're supposed to hear about UFOs and some big report, I'm not buying into that. I'm on the more worried side of things, that if they have the technology to build a spaceship to come to Earth and fly in ways that we can't even understand, they're not going to come down and be friendly necessarily, or ask us to join their big nation of different star systems. They don't have to. The only hope we have is that they're not like us, and they don't just see us as a new unspoiled land to take everything from.
Well, speaking of, let's get back to the pickle, because he eventually arrives after slaying a bunch of demons in the form of rats and others as a pickle in his cockroach body. He finally arrives to the family therapy session and engages in a spirited debate with the therapist about whether or not her profession is valid. He seems to think not. And here is her response.
The only connection between your unquestionable intelligence and the sickness destroying your family is that everyone in your family, you included, use intelligence to justify sickness. You seem to alternate between viewing your own mind as an unstoppable force and as an inescapable curse. You chose to come here, you chose to talk, to belittle my vocation, just as you chose to become a pickle.
I love that. Just as you chose to become a pickle.
Right. And I know what you said there. Rick kind of thought he was going to get some shots in at therapy, because it's kind of the inside rather than the doing and the action that he is all about. And she got her shots right back at him. And, you know, it's one of those things that if this was real life, I think that would have led to some more character development and growth. But it's a character on a animated comedy series. So you're not going to see Rick in this coming season going, you know, I really remember what the therapist said, and I think we're going to work on that. But I thought she got some good shots in. I think science needs to be reminded of that every now and then that even though sometimes the stuff that science can do and scientists can pull off can kind of give us a little bit of a feel of there's nothing we can't. We need to rein it in just a little bit. And that was a very useful type of thing for Rick.
Well, Matt, thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Yeah. Matt Brady, he's a high school science teacher, and his book is called The Science of Rick and Morty, The Unofficial Guide to Earth's Stupidest Show. And you can catch season 5 of Rick and Morty Sundays at 11 at night during the Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Coming up, Joni Mitchell's groundbreaking album Blue is 50 years old today. We'll tell you why it was so groundbreaking next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and it's all bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Oh, but California, California, I'm a coming home.
Well, today marks the 50th anniversary of Joni Mitchell's most beloved album, Blue.
Hey, Blue, there is a song for you in Conopin. Underneath the skin, an empty space to fill.
Well, this album was created as she traveled the world in search of herself, of freedom, of escape. Now the album is being celebrated with an EP of outtakes, demos, and never-before-heard music. Joining us to talk about the release is Jen Pelly, contributing editor for the music publication Pitchfork, and she wrote about Blue for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to the making of Blue. Where was Joni Mitchell in her life at the time?
Joni Mitchell wrote much of the material for Blue after she was at a crossroads of her life and had turned down a marriage proposal and left California to take a trip through Europe and explore the world and herself. She had been to Greece and France, and she came back to California and recorded the album. And hearing that recording that you just played, my jaw dropped when I heard that. It was really mind-blowing to hear these earlier drafts of songs that have been a part of my life for as long as I can remember.
Mm. Well, how many of these have been released now?
The EP has 5 songs on it, and there are earlier versions of A Case of You and California, and there is also a song on the EP called Hunter. I had read in books that when Joni made Blue, she at the very last minute removed 2 songs from it. I believe the songs she removed were Urge for Going and the song Hunter, and she replaced them with All I Want and The Last Time I Saw Richard. This song Hunter I knew was an outtake from Blue that I had never been released, and it was really incredible to hear for the first time.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. This is Hunter.
I heard him cry through my window shade and filled me so full of fright. But I could not turn my back on him. I put on the back porch light. Can I help you, said the good Samaritan. Can I help you, said the good Samaritan.
So, Jen, why was the song not on the original album?
Good question. I imagine that, like, All I Want and The Last Time I Saw Richard are 2 songs on the record that, to me, really are powerful examples of how Joni Mitchell was narrating interior life from the perspective of a woman and really architecting a whole way of being a woman in the world.
And which is why this album is so remarkable and why it has become such an iconic album. But at the time, what was the reaction to Blue and the fact that so many of these songs are incredibly confessional? I think you described it in your article as autobiographical songwriting, a blueprint, if you will, for future singer-songwriters.
Yeah, for me, as someone who I probably heard Blue for the first time in 2005 when I was in high school, to go back and to read what people were saying about the album when it first came out is shocking. There's a new piece in the LA Times written by Jessica Hopper where she quotes the original New York Times review, which predicted that Blue would be the most disliked of Miss Mitchell's recordings, despite the fact that attempts more and makes greater demands on her talent than any of the others. And Jessica also in her article refers to the Rolling Stone review that said it reeked of self-pity.
So this was her fourth album, so she was fairly established. What did her fans think?
Joni has herself talked in interviews about how it was slow to catch on. It wasn't like the album came out and was immediately beloved, that it took a few years before people really realized how groundbreaking it was.
Let's hear a demo version of Case of You, which, as you say, is on this new EP. And then we'll hear the remastered version of it. So first, here is the demo.
On the back of a cartoon coaster pad that didn't make me laugh at all, I drew a map of Canada, oh Canada, and I charted our last squall. Oh, you are in my blood like holy wine. You taste so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and I'd still be on my feet. I would still be on my feet.
So that's the demo. And here's the version that appears on the album.
Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. You taste so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you.
Wow, that voice. Jen, what do you think when you hear the two versions?
I think it's really humanizing to hear a demo version of this song that has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. And it's interesting because you think, how could Joni Mitchell's music be more human than it already is? Mm-hmm. But a song in its unfinished state, I think, is also really interesting because so much of her music is about kind of unresolved feelings and feelings that are like questions. To me, to hear a unfinished version of a song that is about an unfinished feeling, I think is really cool. That song in particular is probably my favorite song on Blue.
It is a fantastic song. And this is a song that has been covered. And as I say, has her music and this album in particular has influenced so many artists. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It really does to me feel kind of like talking about a color. Like, her songwriting is that elemental to me and has been for as long as I've been a serious music fan, like the holy grail of songwriting. It's interesting because I think it also, her influence defies genre, which makes it even trickier to try to measure the extent of her influence. I think people are going to be talking about and trying to measure the influence of this album for a really long time. Her imprint on pop music, of course, is undeniable and massive, but also on indie rock and in jazz also.
Why did she call it Blue?
Something that I write about in my piece is that Joni was really inspired particularly by painting and jazz, and she loved Picasso and Miles Davis, two artists who also had their blue periods.
Yeah, and was she feeling blue at the time or as well? I mean,
well, that's an interesting question because, yes, I feel like the album is thought of as this extremely sad, morose album, but I don't think that is actually the reality of the totality of the music. When you listen to songs like Carrie or California, it doesn't all sound sad. she sings on the first song, I Want to Wreck My Stockings in Some Jukebox Dive. That's pretty joyful to me.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jen Pelley, contributing editor for Pitchfork, and we've been talking about Joni Mitchell and her album Blue, which is 50 years old today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.
Songs are like tattoos, you know I've been to see before. Crown and anchor me, or let me sail away. Hey, Blue, there is a song for you, ink on a pin. Underneath the skin, an empty space to fill. There is your song from me.